This is When Orla Met, a conversation with and about some of the leading athletes, engaging brains, and fascinating characters in sport. For this two-part episode, I've done something a little bit different, chatting to one of the leading figures in the world of cycling, not so much about his history, fascinating though it is, but about his thoughts on the concept of clean sport, why it even matters, and whether cheating can ever be eliminated when we're hardwired as humans to seek advantage. Jonathan Voters today runs a cycling team, EF Education First, but was also a pro himself, riding with Lance Armstrong back in the day and admitting to doping in the late 90s and early noughties. I caught up with him recently, just before the Tour de France got underway. Here's When Orla Met Jonathan Voters. Jonathan, thank you for taking time out of a busy schedule. We're sitting here in the Vendée region of France the day before the Tour de France gets underway. So I appreciate you taking time out and having a little drink with me. I don't want to just talk about cycling, but obviously it's a sport that you know. It's a sport that you have had a career in both managerially and as a professional. It's a sport that you doped in as well. But I think we can probably extend a lot of what we're going to talk about beyond just cycling. But since we're here and on the eve of the Tour de France, quite a big question to begin with, I guess. Do you believe in clean sport? Is that a concept, that a purity that you think exists in real life?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's possible. I mean, it's certainly difficult, but getting anything to 100% is very, very, very difficult. But do I believe it's possible? Sure. And do I believe that we should strive for that, even if we only get to 98% or 97 or whatever? Yes. The Malcolm Gladwell argument of just let everyone take everything they want and turn people into cyborgs, I think fundamentally it's a flawed argument because I don't think that, not in all sports, but in cycling and in athletics and in some other sort of more pure, sports, I think that people, the reason they're interested in watching the sport and that they invest emotional energy into the sport is that they want to know who's the best. Like, it's interesting. I think we're hardwired as humans from a little bit of a Darwinian perspective of wanting to know who's the best. It's sort of our primitive tribal something or other that really has that desire. And in order to know who's the best, you have to know that nobody's cheating. And so from a purely pragmatic standpoint, that's why I continue to believe in strong anti-doping efforts and that, whether or not we get it perfect or not is it's not irrelevant, but to me it's less important than that we're actually putting the best effort in that we possibly can, because I don't think people would be as interested if it was just racing motorcycles.
And yet people are interested in racing motorcycles and they're interested in, for example, Formula One. So when technology and science mixes with human ability, then there is an interest there. So when people say that actually on a purely entertainment level, if we were to allow everybody to dope and just sit back and watch, to put it crudely, the freak show, then that still would be entertaining, wouldn't it? I mean, what do you think of that?
Yeah, it would be entertaining. I just don't see the demographic that's interested in cycling following that. I think... that demographic would sort of look at it as, well, this is really slow and boring compared to motorcycle racing, so why bother? I think the demographic of people that are interested in cycling are people that are, they're interested in pushing themselves, they're interested in being athletic themselves, they're interested, a lot of them, especially in the UK and the US, a lot of them ride themselves, and so they... like that's where they sort of have a common language, in some ways, or a connection to the professional athletes. And if that's just pulled apart by pharmaceuticals or other forms of cheating, I don't think that crowd sticks around. I mean, maybe a different in the crowd, and you say, well, yeah, but a different crowd would come in. I don't think that happens either, because I think that different crowd is interested in Formula One and is interested in motorcycle racing and is interested in American football, and that crowd, they're just not necessarily the same people. So I think cycling would just lose the audience that it has and wouldn't gain you know, an additional audience.
So clean sport matters because of the people watching it and what they invest in it. Does it matter as well? I mean, one of my arguments has always been that it has to, I mean, it comes back to why sport matters to society, really. And if I look at, I've got a daughter, a 3-year-old daughter, and I want her to be able to look at sporting heroes and heroines and think that she can achieve that in a wholesome way, just out of, I guess, a pursuit of a good life. So does it come back to who you think the sport matters for and what sort of role sport serves in society?
Yeah, I mean, you're basically describing yourself as the demographic that I just described, as someone who's into cycling, who wants their child to be able to pursue a sport without having to compromise their moral compass. And I think that's, you know, that's something that there's another argument for doing everything you can to keep the sport clean, is that why, if we just let everyone dope or do whatever they wanted to, you're eliminating a huge number of people that their moral compass would just feel like that's wrong, or they'd be concerned about their health, or they just wouldn't be, or, you know, health risks and so on and so forth. They just wouldn't be willing to do that to their body. And that whole group of athletes is just thrown away. They're just tossed to the side. And that's sort of been one of my arguments over and over again about anti-doping, is that it's, you know, it's about keeping it so that the kid who has the dream, who has, like, because we culturally we all have different moral compasses from different, you know, different places in the world, different cities, different families, so on and so forth, that everyone should sort of be given an equal opportunity, and that there shouldn't be this, well, unless you're willing to kind of bend the rules a little bit, you can't fit in here. Because that's what I experienced, as, you know, in the 1990s when I came into the sport, is it was, the mentality was just so much that, you know, you gotta twist things a little bit. You gotta bend the rules a little bit. You gotta do what you gotta do. That was the thing. You gotta get the job done. You know, you need to do this for your sponsor, blah, 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 right? And that really, I watched that corrupt a lot of people. A lot of people who are actually genuinely, you know, very solid human beings, good people who went on, you know, later in life to continue to be really good people, not people that were compulsive cheaters or, you know, hardened sociopaths or whatever. They were there. It's just that they wanted to fit in. And so they decided that the choice was sort of like, well, I guess I'm going to have to lie a little bit to my family, you know, the people who raised me, who set this moral compass for me. I'm going to have to lie to them a little bit because I don't want to disappoint anyone. I don't want to be successful in this, and I've spent so much time at it. And like, that's just a crappy place to put someone in their early 20s, to just basically saying you need to sort of compromise who you are in order to do what you love. That's just horrible.
And if you look at the other side of that, so you mentioned the 1990s when you came into the sport, you rode with Lance Armstrong for a year on US Postal. And it was an era when, certainly in hindsight, everybody looks back and says, yep, well, everybody was at it. And the old argument is that if you were doping, you were simply levelling the playing field. Were you all levelling the playing field? And did that in some ways make it fair?
I understand the argument. Physiologically, it's that argument doesn't hold a lot of water, and the reason is really simple. So let's imagine that instead of me having a glass of rosé and you having a Coca-Cola Light, that we go out and have 27 shots of tequila. So tomorrow morning, we both wake up. We both feel horrible. We both have pounding headaches. Well, I go to the medicine cabinet and I take 2 aspirin, and my headache's gone in half an hour. And you go to the medicine cabinet and take 2 aspirin and nothing happens. Then you take 4 aspirin and it's a little bit better. And then you take another 2 aspirin and a Tylenol and whatever. And eventually you get rid of your headache. That's what happens with people's bodies with doping, is that some people are incredibly, their bodies improve a lot with doping, and other people, their bodies only improve a little bit. You know, you could see that very numerically, you know, back in my days on U.S. Postal Service, with the guys who had low natural hematocrits versus the guys who had high natural hematocrits, right? You know, George Hincapie was a guy who, as an example, had a very high natural hematocrit. Now, he doped and he's admitted it. When he would dope, you'd barely notice the difference with him. He'd ride maybe a tiny bit faster, but, you know, his hematocrit was already right at sort of the limit anyway, so it didn't really seem like much was happening. Whereas conversely, a guy like Tyler Hamilton, who had a very low natural hematocrit, when he would start doping, it was like a whole new rider showed up on the scene. So they were doing the same thing. Morally, they had made the same step. They had crossed over the line from white to gray to black. They were both in the black. It's not that either one of them were right or wrong, but one of them was getting, you know, a 10, 15% performance advantage, and the other one was getting a 2% performance advantage. So was that fair? No, not at all. I mean, it wasn't, you know, in back to my original statement of determining who's actually the best, in that scenario, we have no idea. We just know who basically, whose body was most ready to suck up the pharmaceuticals and had the, you know, the biggest improvement change due to the pharmaceuticals. So that's not, it's not leveling the playing field.
And yet if we look at sports like, for example, in athletics at the moment, where the IAAF have just decreed not that long ago that if a woman has an unnaturally high level of testosterone, for example, she has to take medicine to lower that. So you've got the likes of Caster Semenya, the South African athlete, who is trying to argue it, but she would have to alter her natural chemistry, which makes her predisposed to being a phenomenal athlete, so that she can level the playing field in reverse. How does that stack up?
I mean, that one's really hard. I've actually watched that with a lot of interest. That, I mean, you know, basically what they're saying is, you know, you're too close to being a man, therefore you need to feminize yourself a little bit so that, you know, you're on a, I mean, whew. yeah, that's sort of one of those, I don't know where to begin on that one. Fundamentally, I kind of disagree with that. I don't think that that's in the view of fairness. I mean, I understand both arguments on that, but I would have to say that, again, back to the first argument that I made is you know, we're determining who's the best at a certain discipline. And if her endocrinological status makes her better at that discipline because of a higher testosterone level, then lowering it just seems as unnatural as raising somebody else's.
And how far do we go with that then? How pure do we become with it? Because if we look at medical treatment, for example, certainly in an event like the Tour de France, the 3 weeks on the road make it one of the most grueling sporting events that there are. And part of winning the Tour is having a body that simply survives it. Mm. So if you suffer from dehydration or you fall ill or you fall off your bike and break a collarbone, should there be an argument that actually no medicine should be allowed whatsoever because you're allowing each and every individual to prove how much their bodies independently can withstand all of those conditions?
Yeah, I understand your argument. And I think, to me, the answer to that is that it's just that the rules need to be the same for everyone, wherever that line is. Because that line, it's weird. I mean, you could take it all the way back to, you know, I don't know, cheese. If you eat cheese contains, you know, glucose, which is performance enhancing, and it contains amino acids, which are going to help with recovery. And so, you know, should we ban eating cheese? Okay, well, clearly not. All the way to, you know, blood transfusions and EPO and so on and so forth. Should we ban that? Well, yes. So then it's like, okay, now where's the middle? Is the middle like, well, what about vitamin C? Just a vitamin C tablet. Where does that fall? Or where does, you know, a super special electrolyte drink that keeps you hydrated for longer, where does that fall? Or where do amino acids fall? Or just supplementation in general or sports nutrition in general? And you can argue that it should be a little bit more to the left or a little bit more to the right all day long. And I don't think either one of those arguments is right or wrong. I think, and this probably actually applies to the testosterone case that we were just talking about too, is that what does apply is that it just needs to be the same for everyone and consistently applied so that everyone just sort of knows, okay, you know, I can take a vitamin C tablet and that's fine. And, you know, nobody's going to have a problem with that. And I can be transparent about that. I can go out to the media and say, I took a vitamin C tablet or I took amino acids or whatever, and everyone's fine with that. But I can't take, growth hormone, and I can't go out and say to the media, I took growth hormone, and I can't tell WADA I took or whatever. That if you can't be transparent, I mean, this is, you know, our old media officer on the team, Mariah Pongrace, and a lot of times when Prentice, Stefan, our old physician, I would be having these debates like, well, you know, should we be doing intravenous vitamin B12 or whatever, right? Like these debates of like, theoretically, should we, is this over that line or is this under the line? Or it's within the WADA code, but is it within our own team's ethos and blah, 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 right? And Prentice is really basically the founder of the no needles policy. But what Mariah would tell Prentice and I as we were having these debates is she said, just think of it like this, guys, that when you're doing whatever it is you're going to do, you're giving somebody vitamin C, you're giving them a vitamin B12 injection, you're whatever, that the entire audience of the Tour de France on the side of the road, that they can see you doing it. Now ask yourselves, would you do it still? And if the answer is yes, then I think it's fine to do it. And if the answer is no, then maybe you shouldn't. And I think that's actually, that was sort of a fair policy. I mean, that's almost the moment that Prentice said, well, geez, maybe we shouldn't just be using injectable products at all because, like, nobody on the side of the road would really like that. Well, yeah, probably. So.
And that sounds, in theory, like a really good litmus test. But a problem that I have as a journalist of many sports is that that's not consistent across sports. And I struggle with that because there is a no needles policy in cycling, but in many, many, and I think pretty much every other sport, there isn't. And so recently at the World Cup, we had one player who was injured, had a groin injury, and received an injection to his groin. Yep. Like we said, it was a sugar injection. We don't know. There wasn't, I don't think, the same probity of journalism that maybe we would get if it was a cycling incident. Where does the moral landscape lie with that across all the different sports?
Well, sports just aren't... People have different expectations of different sports. And that's, I think, something that we have to accept. Which is hard. I mean, I can tell you being in cycling, because cycling is the sport that is most scrutinized. And so inside of cycling, you're getting scrutinized, whatever, for salbutamol and TUEs and so on and so forth, whereas, like, in American football, that's like candy. It's not even, I mean, those things are nothing. And what they can do, I mean, it's just absurd, the standard difference. The bar is totally different in the two different sports, but I think that's, like we were talking about earlier, I think people's expectation of cycling derives from, you know, that cyclists are a healthy group of people. It's a low carbon or zero carbon emission sport, that it's healthy, that it's family friendly, that in everyone's childhood, one of the milestone moments in their childhood is when they learned how to ride a bike. It's this family friendly, feel good thing to do, riding your bike through the countryside. And so the expectation of the fans of cycling is that these cyclists that are racing the Tour de France are also healthy human beings that are accomplishing something incredible, and they should be so proud of themselves. It is an organic kale salad of sport. Whereas American football, these are enormous men trying to kill each other. And you don't go and, you know, try to kill each other. I mean, you might play, like, flag football with your buddies or whatever, but, like, you don't go and pad up and, like, you know, have a family outing where, like, your four-year-old actually, you know, breaks his neck in the course of... I mean, it's just... This is not something that is considered healthy. This is not something that anyone does because, you know, it has low carbon impact. And this is not a milestone. American football is just a brutal modern-day gladiator entertainment. And because it's entertainment, and I wouldn't even necessarily put it in the realm of sport in some ways, the expectation is, well, they need to do whatever they can do because there's a, you know, a 200-kilogram man chasing after them, and if they aren't taking drugs, they might die when that person hits them. So, of course, they're taking drugs. Like, I would too, you know. So the expectation is so broadly different from one sport to another. And I don't know that there's really anything we can do about that. I think we just have to kind of accept that certain sports like athletics and cycling people are going to want that to be pure, and they're going to want it to be healthy. And it's sort of our responsibility to do everything we can to live up to that standard.
Are there sports as well then where there's just too much money involved to be really strict when it comes to anti-doping, like American football, where it is a massive entertainment industry? And if we start to get into it in too much detail, then it becomes less competitive and therefore less entertaining. Is it money as well?
I think it would be just as competitive if everyone was clean. It's just, I really think it's just down to the audience doesn't care. I mean, my hometown team, we've won a few Super Bowls, and the Denver Broncos. One of the most famous players on the Denver Broncos, especially in the peak years, was this guy named Von Miller. Early on in Von Miller's career, he gave a sample. Now, just for 1 second, imagine that this would happen in cycling. He gave a urine sample that was determined, it didn't test positive. It was determined that it didn't come from a human being.
I don't know why I'm laughing. That's horrific.
Yeah. And I think it was he got a 3-game suspension for a non-human sample. So, I mean, just for one moment, think about that one in cycling. If the Tour de France winner produces a non-human sample and they say, well, you're not going to be able to race the Clásico San Sebastian. We're really sorry, but you can come back for the Vuelta. I mean, it's just ludicrous when you think of it. But that's what happened. So in the size of the article in the media surrounding him producing this non-human sample was a very small column. It was not the headline. It was not the front page. It certainly didn't detract from the game. People were more upset about the team not being as good because he was gone than they were about the non-human sample.
So does that come back to then what role sport plays in society? And does that mean that different sports play different roles? Because there are clearly some sports there when we are quite comfortable with watching essentially a freak show, as long as that sport fulfills its role in our lives and for the rest of the community.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. I think there are sports that are just purely entertainment, and people aren't interested in participating themselves, and they aren't interested they're not necessarily emotionally invested in the athletes. It's entertainment, but cycling just doesn't fit that. You know, people fall in love with the difficulty of cycling, the fact that it's overcoming something. And I think that's, you know, sort of the struggle of life, which everyone experiences, and the suffering of life, which everyone experiences. It's embodied by the Tour de France. And if you introduce pharmaceuticals from that, it detracts from that sort of connectivity between the audience and the athletes because of, you know, them sort of questioning, well, wait, are they actually still suffering because of the pharmaceuticals? And are they, you know, there needs to be this purity because, you know, a lot of people, especially in the UK and the US that are cycling fans, are bike riders themselves and even bike racers themselves. And, you know, they want to see something incredible and they want to know that, you know, that it's pure.
But if we look at the 1990s, for example, and the pharmaceutical fest that was, and who knows what went on before, because anti-doping wasn't astringent, and we look at since then, we've still had numerous cases at every Grand Tour, really, of a rider being found to have doped. Are we willfully naive in demanding that cycling or a sport like it or athletics, when we've been exposed to it so many times, that it could be and should be clean?
Well, I'd ask you to back up and look at 2008 till now. We'll just take the last decade, because it just was something you said, you know, that every year there's a big, you know, number of people. Well, yes and no. So if you take 2008, right? At 2008, compared to 2006 and 2007, which are like Operation Puerto and Floyd Landis and whatever else, fairly benign tour, right? It was people would say, oh, it was a clean tour, right? Well, let's look at 2008. You had Stefan Schumacher, who won the major time trial of the race, positive for Sarah. You had the fourth place rider, Bernie Cole, who won the King of the Mountains, tested positive for Sarah. You had Leonardo Piopoli and Riccardo Rico, both for, I don't know, Ipo or Sarah. I'm not really sure what it was. There was the one guy on Bartle World that got popped for Ipo as well. I mean, you had like six or seven positives for really hardcore doping in 2008. And that was considered a very benign and quote unquote clean tour relative to 2007 and 2006, right? Okay. So then keep going forward. Each year, it's 2008, 2009, 2010. Each year, it's sort of a little bit less, a little bit less, a little bit less. It's, I'll put it this way. Like, I see the improvement, and it's there. But Taylor Finney, actually, this is probably the best quote I've heard of this. He said, well, I think there has been an improvement. And he said, why? He's like, well, you know, people used to dress up on the side of the road as syringes. Now they dress up on the side of the road as giant inhalers. He's like, that's moving forward. And I mean, I really do see that. If what we're concerned about right now is salbutamol and cortisone TUEs, man, is that better than EPO and blood transfusions and growth hormone and testosterone. I mean, it's a whole world better. It means basically that we've gone from things that make a 10% difference to things that make a 0.05% difference. And does that mean the sport's perfectly clean? No. But does that mean that we've improved immensely and gone in the right direction? Absolutely. And what actually makes me angry is that nobody ever takes two steps back and looks at that and says, you know, holy moly, actually, this has gotten a lot better, because everyone's so focused on just like the latest, you know, I don't know. It's frustrating.
Well, that's the thing. Because how do we explain the hysteria then? Because you mentioned the cortisone TUEs and salbutamol, both in reference, I guess, to Team Sky. And we see recently, that was Sir Bradley Wiggins, and then recently with Chris Froome. And Chris Froome has been cleared by the International Cycling Union, by the World Anti-Doping Agency, for exceeding in his urine sample the permitted dose of the asthma drug salbutamol. Now, he's been cleared and of something that, as you say, in relation to the history of the sport, is quite minor anyway. And yet, the level of hysteria that we see around that, and certainly, I don't know if you follow in the British newspapers, there is an awful lot of hand-wringing of that and very little, if any, mention of anything that happens in other sports. How do we explain that?
Yeah, I mean, I wish I knew exactly. I just, quite simply, cycling is held to a much higher standard than other sports. I mean,
is that fair enough, though, given the past, given the history?
Well, I think it is fair enough. But it is interesting. I mean, I go back to, you know, when I first admitted to doping in 2012, the overwhelming sentiment was very positive and very supportive, and thank you for being honest and so on and so forth. But there were some detractors, and it was interesting. Those detractors, a lot of them were, you know, people that I raced with when I was, say, like 15 years old, and they had also attempted to become professional riders and spent, you know, a decade living in their parents' basement and training full-time and not going to university and so on and so forth, and probably, you know, being called a, you know, a bit of a deadbeat by their parents and by their girlfriend and by their whoever. And it was like this momentous occasion when, you know, I came out and said I doped, because it was like this moment where they could say, oh my gosh, now I can go back to my parents and say, Mom, Dad, I wasn't a loser when I was living in your basement. It was just that everyone was cheating. I was cheating. And that was very far from the truth. I mean, none of the U.S. Postal Service were doped to become a professional. It was very much once they were already very established on the world scene, then looking for that last little bit, you know, doped. But the emotion there made me realize, you know, that people who are cyclists and who are involved in cycling are very predisposed to, you know, kind of they're looking for, you know, an absolute parity, and they're looking for any reason that they aren't as good as the next guy. And I think that's also maybe a little Darwinian too, in that, you know, if you just know straight up that you got dropped on this climb, or you couldn't keep up or whatever, that, you know, you think of yourself as like a lesser human. And again, since so many people who are cycling fans are cyclists themselves, it's all of a sudden like I think of myself as less than these professional riders. I am not as good of a human being. Darwinianly, I don't get to, you know, reproduce or whatever, right? And that just, I think, leads to this enormous emotional charge that when somebody does produce a positive, they say, oh my gosh, like, look at that. Like, actually, I am as good. I am as good. I was just cheated out of it. And I think that and, you know, running, it's the same thing, right? There are a lot of people who are runners and they don't want to be thought of as less than the guy who can run, you know, a 210 marathon. They want to be thought of as just as good. And, you know, why can't I get lower than a 230 marathon? Well, clearly it's because they're all doping and I'm not. And so I think for some reason, cycling and running, and you could probably mention a few others, really lend themselves to sort of that sort of outrage and backlash and jealousy and envy and so on and so forth. Whereas football, I don't think any of us, American football, I just go back to this, it's the easiest analogy, right? The American football, you know, 99.9999% of the population of the United States has no illusion that they could ever be a football player. That there's no thought of like, if I got out on that field and I took a bunch of steroids and put on, you know, pads and a helmet, I could probably be, I mean, there's just no way. It's like, no, you just get smushed. Like, it's just not even close. But, you know, and that's because you can physically see, or NBA, they're incredibly tall. You can see the difference. But in cycling, you know, most cyclists, professional cyclists, they just kind of look like normal guys. They're really skinny, but that's about it, you know? And so everyone thinks, well, I could do that. I kind of look like that guy. I'm, you know, I'm 5'10" as well. And I weigh this. Well, okay, I'll do that. And so it lends itself to this because it's subtle. The differences are subtle. The differences are inside. It's how big your heart is. It's how your mitochondrial functions are, you know, so on and so forth. It's much more subtle. And so I think that people, the dream becomes alive that I could be a pro. And when that dream doesn't happen, it's like they become envious and jealous. And I don't know. I think the root of it is in there somewhere, that cycling is so held to such a high standard.
Isn't it quite Darwinian anyway, though, to always look for an edge, to always look to push the boundaries, to be better than your rivals? And if so, how do you square that with ever thinking that we can eliminate cheating?
Yeah, I mean, it's very difficult. I mean, there's always going to be someone that is going to want to cheat. I mean, always. There's no way around that. And as you said earlier, when a lot of money gets involved, that pressure and temptation gets higher and higher and higher. And I don't think it is actually realistic for us to say, you know, it's going to be pure. But what I do think is realistic is to say we're going to do everything we can to make it pure. And will there be things that fall through the cracks? Sure. But the intention of 100% effort has to be there. I don't see any other way around it. I mean, that's just the way it is. And I know that everyone is looking for this sort of black or white. You know, we need a clean sport, 100%. I need to be sure that my champion, that my guy is clean. And, you know, I don't know if there's ever any way that you can be 100% certain. You can be 99% certain. And that's, I think, you know, there's a lot of things we can still do on the level of transparency with anti-doping. I mean, for years now, I've been saying that it's absolutely ludicrous that each team is only paying 140,000, or maybe it's 108, I don't know. Anyway, it's 100 and something thousand euros into, you know, the anti-doping foundation of the UCI. That's the war kitty for anti-doping. That's absurd. I mean, it should be like 5% of the budget of every team. For the largest problem that exists in the sport, the amount of spending that goes into anti-doping should be way higher than it is right now. You know, so there are things we can still do. There are improvements to be made. But to have an expectation of absolute black and white, I just, that doesn't exist in life. You know, that's like asking for New York City to be completely crime-free. I mean, you can say, is it safe to live in New York City? Yes. Can I succeed in New York City without stealing? Yes. You know, do... whatever, when I walk to a bar at 1 o'clock in the morning in New York City, you know, am I afraid of getting mugged? No. So, okay, those are all great things. Is the city 100% crime free then? Oh, well, no. No, it's 99% crime free, but it's not 100% crime free. I think that's sort of the framework that we have to start looking at anti-doping in, and just it's striving for improvement as opposed to demanding perfection.
Coming up in the next episode.
You just become worn down by always being second fiddle. You become worn down by always being an also-ran. You become worn down by reading in the media, we thought this guy was going to be really good, but apparently he's a bit of a disappointment. You know, yeah, I mean, that kind of thing really stings.
That's in the next episode of When Orla Met. And a huge thank you to the wonderful Jonathan Rowe for editing this episode. If you've missed any of my chats so far from cycling and beyond with Mark Cavendish, Lizzie Deignan, Judy Murray, or Sir A.P. McCoy, amongst others, you can find them all on When Orla Met. And if you've liked the conversations, well, I would love it if you left a review on iTunes. Feel free to drop me a line as well, orla@whenorlamet.com. And to not miss out on any of the chats still to come, discussions and debates as well, please do subscribe to When Orla Met.